pleasure to be able to introduce Rabbi Grunstein. He really needs no introductions to us here because he's been a regular at Central. He has been to Ashur on many occasions and in fact has helped us with the recruitment of previous Rabbonim to our community. He, of course, his main role is the Director of Placements at Strauss Amiel, which is Rabbi Torah Stone, which we know so well. He's an educator and really a very articulate speaker, and we look forward to now hearing from him on a subject around that, of course, of Yom Yerushalayim, which is tomorrow. So over to you, Rabbi Grunstein.
Thank you very, very much, Jeffrey. Thank you, Joshi, for organizing this evening. It's a pleasure to be with you. I haven't been in Birmingham since, I believe, 2016. And the second best thing under the COVID is at least to see you via the screen. So it's great to see so many familiar faces. And if we have time afterwards, it will be great to catch up after the lecture. I'd love to begin if... we'll do that right now. I'm going to be sharing here a screen, and I hope everyone sees it. Okay, if everyone sees it, then we're good. And let's begin. The topic that I suggested to Joshi, amongst the various topics, was the topic of speaking English in Israel. Is it tolerated or is it preferable? Namely, when I came to Israel in 1988, and as you hear from my accent from the United States, and even worse off, from New York, that accent can be very annoying for those that didn't grow up there. I was told time and again, every time I spoke to an Anglo, what you see on the left side of your screen, Daber Ivrit, speak in Hebrew. Namely, you're in Israel now, you have to speak the Jewish language, which is Hebrew, and therefore speak in Hebrew, which is not only the language of the land, it's also the Jewish language. Having said that, even back in 1988 and to this day, if you look at the little sign on the right side of your screen, you'll see that almost all signs in Israel are at least in Hebrew and in English. This is the sign from Hamisrad Liklitat Aliyah, literally the office in order to absorb all those that decide to make Aliyah and live in Israel. And as you can see here, it says Ministry of the Interior, Ministry of Immigrant Absorption, and therefore it's not only in English, it's obviously here in Russian and other languages, in Arabic. But quite frankly, if you look on the Tel Aviv highway, and many of you I'm sure have traveled it before COVID and hopefully afterwards, you'll see that the signs are both in Hebrew and in English. And I guess my question is the ideal for all of us here in Israel to be speaking Hebrew? And therefore, in my own home, when I speak to my kids and my wife in English, I should sort of begin by saying, I apologize, I feel more comfortable in English. Namely, it's tolerated. It's not something that's ideal. Or maybe it's actually preferable that even in Israel, the Jewish homeland, where the national language is Hebrew, the language that we daven with, the language we lain in, the language we lament in on Tisha B'Av, the language that we celebrate with on Purim, that language, as important as it is not a language that we need to use day in and day out here in Israel, if indeed you'd like to use other languages. And I don't think this is just a practical question, namely, do you know Hebrew? And if you know Hebrew, do you want to speak it on a regular level? But rather, I believe it's a question on principle. And that is, what is Israel all about? And in order to go ahead and to start this topic, allow me to begin with a small introduction. And that is there any value at all in speaking Hebrew? Outside of the fact that here in Israel, we speak in Hebrew as the national language, we joke in Hebrew, we kvetch in Hebrew, we complain in Hebrew, is indeed there a value in Judaism in speaking Hebrew? This was a question right at the beginning of the state. And as you could see here on the screen, you could see that it says as follows, as early as 1937, there was a little advertisement in the newspaper that said, Hasiru et shemot hanichar mekir bechem. Take away the foreign, Goyisha, if I can use that term, take away the non-Jewish family names, surnames, from your names. Leave your Jewish name, but change your last name. And indeed, many of the early leaders of the State of Israel did exactly that. They sort of said, we came from a certain place, but the minute we came in to the border of Israel, we're a new land, we're a new person, and we're going to change our name. And therefore, all the following gentlemen and lady on the screen did exactly that. David Green became David Ben-Gurion. You see him here standing on his head. Levi Shkolnik became Levi Eshkol, the prime minister of the day we're celebrating this evening and tomorrow, Yom Yerushalayim. Moshe Shertuk, the second prime minister of Israel, became Moshe Sharet. And Abba Ibn didn't start as Abba Ibn. His name was Oberi Ibn. And Golda Meyerson was Golda Meir. Shimon Pirsky became Shimon Peres. And there was a certain attitude then that I'd like to sum up in two words called Shlilat Hagalut. Namely, totally negate the exile. Everyone came from Russia, from Poland, from Germany, from Morocco, from all these lands. Once you come in to the borders of the land of Israel, you disconnect from anything outside of it, and you become a new Jew with a new name. As a matter of fact, David Ben-Gurion refused to allow officers to become high-ranking officers in the IDF if they didn't change their surname. And this was sort of the attitude for many, many years in Israel. Namely, even if you didn't change your surname, you were supposed to come into Israel and say, I'm a new person, and therefore I speak only Hebrew. My last name is changed to show I'm a new person, and I have nothing to learn from anything outside of Israel. Or if I could put it another way, Jeffrey mentioned earlier that my full-time job is not speaking to you, unfortunately. That would be enjoyable. But rather placing rabbis around the world. And within that job of placing rabbis, when I usually get a new cadre of rabbis, I always ask them a very simple question. What is our responsibility towards the Jews in the diaspora? And their answer always is to induce them to make aliyah, and that's about it. And then I say, do you have a second question? Do you have anything to learn from them? And the answer is no. We only can influence them, but we have nothing to learn from them. We're Israelis. We're living in the right place. We're speaking the right language. We have nothing to learn from anything outside of Israel. Outside of Israel could be summed up in two words, assimilation and a great place to vacation, to go on holiday. That's it. And my question this evening is this attitude the Jewish attitude? And let's begin by seeing, on this specific question, if there's anything in terms of value to speaking Hebrew, is there a value to speaking Hebrew in Judaism? The Yerushalmi Talmud in Masechet Shabbos says like this, Kol mishehu kavua be'eretz Yisrael, whoever lives permanently in Israel and does this and does that and amongst many things, umedaber bilashon hakodesh, and speaks in Hebrew, Muftach lo shehu mechayei ha'olam haba. We give him a promise that he's going to inherit the world to come. That's a pretty big high value. Namely, if you speak in Hebrew, together with reading Shema, living in Israel, you're going to inherit a great world to come. The Rambam, in his interpretation to Masechet Avot, which is the custom to learn during the Shabbos between Pesach and Shavuos, when the Mishnah says in Masechet Avot the following words, "Vahavei zahir b'mitzvah kala kevechamura, she'en ata yodea matan tzcharan shel mitzvot." Be very careful when you keep commandments. Whether you think the commandment is easy or hard, keep them equally. For a very simple reason. When it comes to prohibitions, how do we know which prohibition is higher up there? Anyone? How do we know the hierarchy of prohibitions in Judaism? Answer is by its punishment. If the punishment's more severe, then it's a higher up there in terms of its graveness. When it comes to positive commandments, we have no idea. We don't know if sitting in the sukkah on sukkahs versus saying Shema which is more important. I really don't know which is more important this morning, wearing tefillin or saying Shema. I don't know which is more important on the Seder night. If they're all rabbinic commandments, I'm not sure which is more important, drinking the 4 cups of wine or reclining. So says the Mishnah, be careful with positive commandments, whether they're easy or hard. Explains the Rambam, whose alleged picture is here. You know that when it comes to pictures of these medieval scholars, it's not like someone took a photo and saved it for us. This is obviously alleged. So if the Rambam looked like this, says the Rambam, Shera'oi lihizaher b'mitzvah, she'yichashev b'shehikala, be very careful with what you perceive as easy mitzvot. Kigon, like, simchat haregel, next week we have the holiday of Shavuos, being happy on the holiday of Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, ve lemidat lashon hakodesh, and learning Hebrew. So according to the Rambam, no more, no less. Not only is it virtuous, you can inherit the world to come according to the Jerusalem Talmud, but literally it's a mitzvah to speak in Hebrew. A mitzvah. As a matter of fact, my own Rebbe and mentor, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichrono Levracha, whose birthday would have been tonight, tomorrow, Yom Yerushalayim, he spoke to his kids in Hebrew for that reason, even though he knew a perfect English. As a matter of fact, he had a doctorate in English. Quite frankly, he spoke to his kids in Hebrew, even in America, and obviously when they made Aliyah, because he felt it was a mitzvah. So his wife spoke to them in English, and he spoke to them in Hebrew. So according to the Rambam, it's not just virtuous, it's a mitzvah. Just to add one more source, the Yalkut Shimoni is a beautiful book of almost all the Midrashim of our sages on the verses in the Torah, in the Nevi'im and in the Ketuvim, over the entire Bible. It was done much later than most of the Midrashim put together, but it's ancient. And this is what it says. V'limadetem otam et b'neichem, we say in the Shema twice a day, and you shall teach your children. Mikan amru, from here we derived. Kishehatinok matchil ledaber, when a boy or a girl begins to speak. Aviv medaberimo lashon hakodesh. Translation, you speak to them in the holy language. So I'm sure there's many Jews out there that think this means that you don't speak to them in English, and you don't speak to them in German, and you don't speak to them in Moroccan. You speak to them, of course, in the national language of Jews. What's the national language of Jews? So I didn't think it was Hebrew. I told this recently to a chassid, and he told me, of course, the holy language, Yiddish. You're supposed to teach your kid Yiddish from an early age. I mean, I'm sure you all heard this. When I was a kid, this is what they always told us. If you have nothing nice to say, say it in Yiddish. So indeed, that's what I thought it meant. It turns out they're wrong. It means Hebrew. It doesn't mean Yiddish. Namely, when your boy or your girl begin to speak to them in Hebrew. Literally learn from a pasuk that we say twice a day in the Shema. So, there is value to speaking in Hebrew. Either it's virtuous, according to the Rambam, literally a mitzvah, or perhaps even derived from a verse in the Torah. So there is virtue in speaking in Hebrew, and therefore around the world, I've encouraged all my students to do what they can to try and incorporate Hebrew into the Jewish schools they're involved in, into the various synagogues that they're leading. Hebrew should be part and parcel of the Jewish experience. However, I guess my question this evening is not if it's virtuous, but rather, can we also speak English, especially here in Israel? And I'd like to suggest this evening that it's not just tolerated, it's actually preferable for 3 different reasons. And let's go through them. Namely, when I speak to my kids in English, or when I speak to a neighbor in English, and someone comes by and says, Daber be'ivrit, why don't you speak in Hebrew? I give an answer on the quip, like a cynical Israeli does. That's what you do in Israel when someone tells you on the street anything. But here this evening, I'm not here to quip back cynically. I'm here to explain why I believe, ideally, speaking English in Israel is not just tolerated, but preferable. For 3 different reasons. Number 1, the Jewish way has always been that in order to build a future, you give credence to the past. In order to look forward, you look backwards, you say thank you for everything that came before you, and you move forward. I'm standing on the shoulders of my parents, grandparents that came before me. And I believe that when you speak in English in Israel, if you came from a country speaking English, you're actually, it's a form of showing gratitude and recognition of where you came from. And I'll explain what I mean. We mentioned before the Rambam, let's mention him again. When the Rambam codifies how a Jew comes to bring his first fruits, which mitzvah begins on the holiday of Shavuos and goes through Sukkot, when you come to bring your first fruits to the temple, you have to start and thank God. How do you say thank you Jewishly? So it's not by saying Todah Rabbah or thank you or any other word that's a synonym of thank you. But rather, you do as follows. Hi shitzivanu lesaper tovotav v'sher hitiv lanu v'hitzil otanu. You have to go and thank God for everything he's done to you to this day. Both saving you, and if he didn't save you, then obviously all the good things that he did, if it wasn't just saving from life to death, obviously you have various things you have to thank God for. And where do you begin? Matchil b'inyan Yaakov Avinu. You don't start with, I was born in 1977, but rather you start with Yaakov. You saved him. You know, he had a very hard life. His brother Esav tried to kill him. His father-in-law Lavan, like all father-in-laws, try to go ahead and try to kill their son-in-law. This is what happened. Quite frankly, Yaakov had a hard life. You start by thanking God for what he did to him. Next, Umisayim ba'avodat ha-mitzrim va'onatam otanu. You go on to the Egyptians. We were in Egypt. We went from servitude to freedom. Here we are today. Ulip shabcho koza. And you give praise for all of the above. Namely, you start from the beginning of Jewish history until where you are today, and you add on your own line. Like I say at my Seder every year, and I say this all the time, my kids know how to say it Baal Peh, they know it by heart. When you say Dayenu, you start with what's written in the Haggadah, and then you add on your own line. That's the Jewish way of saying thank you. Thank you to those that came before me, up until this day. Now that would explain why, in this particular Siddur that I'm sure you know very well, I must admit it's been over a year that I've held this Siddur in my hand. In the last few years, Jeffrey, you know my travels a bit, you know very well that it hasn't been a few months without me coming to the UK for a Shabbos, for a weekend. I haven't held this Siddur in my hands for over a year. I don't have a copy at home, so as you can see, this is just a picture. So this is the closest I'm getting to holding this Siddur in my hand. In this Siddur, every Shabbos and Yom Tov morning, we add in the passage of Nishmat Kol Chai, towards the end of the introductory service called Pesukei Dezimra. And we thank God for various things. And we say the following words, following suit from the Rambam. We have to thank you, God, for this and for that and for the other thing. And quite frankly, we thank you for elef alfei alafim v'ribei rivavot pe'amim atovot sha'asita im avoteinu v'lanu. The thousands of times that you've helped us and saved us. And once again, mimitzrayim galtanu, you saved us from Egypt. Why all of a sudden do we put it in here? Mibeit avadim petitanu, you took us out of the house of servitude. You're talking Shabbos morning. Thank you, God, for everything you did for me this week. And you start from Egypt. Based on the Rambam, this is the Jewish way. Showing gratitude to those that came before you. And therefore, you start with Egypt, and then you go further. Be'ra'av zanantanu. If we were hungry, you fed us. And when we weren't hungry, there was fruit in the refrigerator. You too went ahead and ensured that we continue to be satiated. And we go on and on talking about the sicknesses we got out of, etc. We keep on going back to the beginning of history and going further. I would like to suggest the first reason why we're supposed to speak English in Israel is to show thanks for the many generations of Anglos that brought us to Israel. We're not just here out of a cotton field. We came here because of endless generations before us that looked out for our Jewish identity and brought us here today. And therefore, by speaking English, you're showing thanks to all those that came before you. And this is not just my innovation, reading it into a Maimonides and into the davening. I believe this is exactly what the Ramban says. Now, the Rambam ends with a mem, the Ramban ends with a nun, known as Nachmanides. You see, in Hebrew, it's very hard when you give a lecture to say Rambam, Ramban. They always get mixed up. When you give a lecture in English, one of the benefits of English is that one is called Maimonides and the other is called Nachmanides. So let's see Nachmanides' alleged picture and what he says. He talks about the fact that this past Shabbos, we did what's called benching Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh, the new Jewish month, begins on Wednesday. The new Jewish month is called Sivan. We're about to finish the month of Iyar. Says the Ramban, isn't that an anti-Torah Jewish statement to make? Why did you just call the months by the names Iyar and Sivan? According to the Torah, you're supposed to call it the first month, the second month, the third month. And this is not just true in the way we speak to each other. We did it in davening when we said Rosh Chodesh Sivan would be on Wednesday. We do it in a legal document called a ketubah at a wedding. We write down the Jewish months as exactly as those names. We don't use number one, number two, number three. Explains the Ramban, and I paraphrase his words even though it's right in front of you. The reason we do that is because the prophet told us that the minute God saved you again, you have to show credence. Namely, God took us out of Egypt, brought us to Israel, but there was an exile. There was a first temple that was destroyed. But 70 years later, we came back from Babel, from Babylonia, to Israel. Says the Ramban, and I quote, "Chazarnu likra chodashim b'shem shenikraim be'eretz Babel." We started to call the months by the Babylonian names, Lahaskir, to remind us, Kishama Matnu, Umishame Elanu Hashem Mitbarach, to remind us that God took us out of there and saved us and brought us back to Israel. Namely, think of the irony. You leave Babylonia, you come back to Israel, and you speak in the language of Babylonia every time you mention the name of the months. Why do you do that? Why don't we go back to our roots and speak in the Hebrew of the Bible? Says the Ramban, it's a show of gratitude, an expression of gratitude that God, you took us out of Babylonia and you brought us to Israel. And therefore, to this moment, we continue to use the months from Babylonia every time we mention a month in order not to negate the fact that we got here because we came from a certain place. And therefore, the first reason why I speak English in Israel, not only, but also, because there is a value to speaking in Hebrew, but the reason is to show gratitude to where I came from. I came from a place where 11 formative years of my life before I made Aliyah, I was in an Anglo country. Yes, I apologize to everyone. It wasn't a proper English, and I'm not proud of my New York accent. Every time I come to England, I apologize for it in my lectures. But I have to give thanks to the people that educated me and brought me at a year, age 11, to this Jewish country. And every time I speak in English, I give gratitude to them. Just like the Ramban says, every time you mention the name of a month, you're giving gratitude to God for taking you out of Babylonia by speaking the language of Babylonia. Reason number one to speak in English is to show gratitude to the past. Reason number two, diversity is the Jewish ideal. I don't believe in putting all the Jews in a straitjacket. I don't believe that we could say about the tragedy that when we went through here in Israel a week ago in Meiron, 45 Jews died. They all look alike. They're all the same. They weren't all the same. There were 45 individuals that the Jewish people lost. And each one was unique in their own way. I would like to suggest that's exactly what happens when I walk the streets of Jerusalem and I hear English and Russian and French. Depends where you are. It depends how much money you have. You'll know where you are in the city of Jerusalem. Quite frankly, the diversity is the Jewish way. And allow me to prove my point from this week's Parsha. We're going to read a very boring Parsha this week. My apologies to the Parsha of the week. It is about numbers and names. That's it. Names of tribes, numbers, where they lived in the desert. As you could see here on the screen, you could see a chart of where everyone lived in the desert. Very interestingly, each tribe or set of tribes had their own flag. And the flag had a certain symbol on it, which symbolized their tribe. Ask the Medrash, ask our sages. Ish al diglo be'otot. It says in the Parsha, each tribe had their own flag and lived in their own neighborhood in the desert. So one Jewish people, one big encampment, but divided up into 12 tribes. Asks the Medrash, Chol ha'umot mistaklim b'hem b'tmein. All the nations of the world looked at this and said, what is this? Are they one nation or are they different nations? V'Yisrael omer, but the Jewish people answered, Magdulatem notnim lanu. What exactly are you looking at? What exactly amazes you? Shema yecholim atem lasot lanu kegdula she'asai Elokim b'midbar. I'll tell you what you're looking at. It's an amazing sight. The Jewish people are one people, and look what God did. He ensured that we'll be one people, but we're not all the same. There's Degel Machane Yehuda, Degel Machane Reuven, Degel Machane Dan, Degel Machane Ephraim. Each tribe had their own flag because each tribe was different from the other tribe. Namely, each one had their own code of arms. I have to admit, before my 4 years in Canada, I had no idea what a code of arms is. But the lieutenant governor of where I was in Canada was actually a member of my shul, and she had an unveiling of her coat of arms, and I had no idea what it was, and everyone tried to explain it to me, until one member of my shul said, you know what Degel Machane Yehuda is? Degel Machane Reuven, the flag of the tribe of Yehuda, the flag of the tribe of Reuven, this is going to be the flag of Myra. I said, oh, now I understand, the flag of Myra. Each tribe had their own flag, and yet they were part of the same nation. Each one was different, and yet they were part of the same nation. And this is not a mistake. This is on purpose. And allow me to give one more source in this regard. Have you heard of the Magen Avraham? The Magen Avraham, Rav Avraham Gumbiner, was one of the primary interpreters on the Code of Jewish Law. So the Code of Jewish Law was written in the 1500s. The 1600s has all the various interpretations around the page of the Code of the Jewish Law. One of the first was the Magen Avraham. And right before he begins the laws of prayer, he says the following words. Omnam, you know, I'm looking around. I live in Poland, Germany, but there's so many different ways you can daven. I mean, let's think about it tonight. There's Ashkenaz. Within Ashkenaz, you have Nusach Ashkenaz, Nusach Sfard, and Nusach Ari. There's three. Then you have the Sfardim. I can't even begin to tell you how many variations there are of the Sephardic davening. Then you have the Yemenite davening. Then you have the Italian way of davening. And the Italians divide up into three groups. Says the Magen Avraham, what's going on over here? Are we one Jewish nation? We have one regulated sitter? How can it be there's so many different ways to daven? Says the Magen Avraham. Om nama minagim shenahagu b'shorshei ha'tfilah en l'shanot b'minhag mekomo. If you have accustomed to daven in a certain way, continue it. Ki yud bet she'arim b'shamayim keneged yud bet shvatim. There are 12 different gates in heaven corresponding to the 12 tribes. Namely, prayers go through 12 different gates. V'chol shevet yesh lo sharam in haglavad. And every tribe has their own gate in order for their prayers to penetrate through. Says the Magen Avraham, we never should have davened in one specific way. There's 12 different ways to daven. 12 different ways to get close to God in prayer. And it's not by mistake, it's on purpose. How do we know it's on purpose? Because of the next source. Thank God the Jewish people leave the desert, come to Israel, and now the land is divided up into 12 tribes. Well, you may say this is by mistake. If everyone got along, we'd be one tribe. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says each tribe had its own judicial system. So imagine this, it's the same Shulchan Aruch, the same code of Jewish law that regulates that judicial system. And yet, each tribe had its own because each tribe was different. And the judges of one tribe wouldn't necessarily understand the sensitivities of another tribe. This makes perfect sense to me today because of the work I'm in. I'll be honest, being a rabbi in the UK is totally different than being a rabbi, say, in North America. One of the big differences is that in the UK, you can make longer sermons. In North America, you take a long sermon, they throw you out by Motzei Shabbos. Number two, in the UK, they respect their rabbis. Not necessarily so around the world, even in Anglo countries. Number three, in the UK, you speak very carefully about various things, but you stay away from telling anyone what is your favorite team in football. In North America, that's like a topic. Oh, you root for this baseball team, not that baseball team. In the UK, you're going to say in Manchester, you're for this team and not that team, you're out of the door. Half the shul hates you. Well, that's just a few differences, top of my head, between two countries. They both speak English. And yet, culturally, they're very, very different. Okay, if I had the time this evening, I can go and tell you all the secrets I know of all the Anglo countries. The differences in the Jewish communities and how they run between Australia, South Africa, the UK, America, and Canada. And they're totally different. Well, even within the Jewish people, in the 12 tribes living in Israel, each tribe had their own judicial system. And when we speak about Jerusalem and its praise, we say Yerushalayim Habnuya, the rebuilt Jerusalem that we're going to see in the future. We're beginning to see it now, and we're going to see it even more. Why is this a beautiful city? Because Shisham Alu Shvatim. Shiftei Ka, Eidut LeYisrael LeHodot LeShem Hashem. Because 12 tribes came to it. Now just imagine what the psalmist is saying here. Jerusalem is beautiful because 12 different tribes with 12 different sensitivities, 12 different cultures, 12 different kinds of jokes, 12 different kinds of recipes, all came to Jerusalem for the three pilgrimage holidays. They were different, but they're part of the same Jewish people. Therefore, in my opinion, this week in the Parsha, we're going to read about each tribe, its numbers, how big it was, how small it was, simply because we want to celebrate the diversity rather than say, oh, it's by mistake. It would have been great if we were all the same. God never wanted us to be all the same, and therefore he divided us into 12 tribes, and it was on purpose. I would like to suggest the second reason why you speak English in Israel, or French, or any other language, is to celebrate this diversity. If we all were the same, that's not the ideal. The ideal is to be different and yet part of the same Jewish nation. If you ask me what's the ideal synagogue, I'd love to see a huge synagogue in Israel. I call it the synagogue of the ingathering of exiles. There'd be 12 different minyanim in the shul at the same time. Sephardi, Ashkenazi, each one divided. We'd have 12 different minyanim, and we'd all come together afterwards for one kiddush. That, in my opinion, is the ideal. It's not the ideal to have a shul where we have to put everyone into a straitjacket and say, either you like it or hit the road. So therefore, my second reason to speak English in Israel is to celebrate the diversity. So the first reason was because I believe it shows gratitude to where you came from. The second reason is diversity is the Jewish ideal. Allow me now to end with the third reason why I believe English in Israel is actually preferable and not just tolerable. And that is, why miss out on each contribution of each community? So if you're against diversity, and if you're against everything I said until now, why is it that I should miss out on what English Jewry could bring to the land of Israel? If we're in a gathering of exiles, then due respect, let me learn from each exile. Let's take the positive of each exile and obviously keep out the negative. Why is it that I shouldn't learn from English Jewry, from American Jewry, from Canadian Jewry, and we should take the best of all worlds and bring it to Israel? It should be a sifter. We should put everything into it, and we should come out with the best. And this is exactly what our prophets prophesied. If you look at the next source, famous source in the Gemara, Masechet Megillah, and I quote, Atidin batei knesiyot ubatei midrashot shebevavel sheyikavu be'eretz Yisrael. In the future, all the shuls in Babylonia, you can cross out Babylonia, all the shuls in the exiles will eventually come to Israel. Now, when I was a kid, I heard this from a Hasidic Rebbe, wonderful man. But when it came to common sense, not exactly high up there. He explained this Gemara by saying, we're going to be sitting here on Shabbos, and God's going to come, pick up this shul, put wings on it, we're going to fly to Israel. How long will it take? He didn't say how long the flight would be. Land in Israel, and that's what's going to be. I don't think that's what it means. But the Gemara does say, all shuls around the world will eventually find their place in Israel. And it brings a verse to prove it. Now, what does this Gemara mean? In our generation, it's not hard to understand. Look at the pictures. You look here on the bottom of the screen, the most famous picture, 770 Eastern Parkway of Lubavitch. This is not a picture of that. This is a picture of its replica in Kfar Chabad, Israel. So when you leave the airport, if you go on the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv highway, towards Jerusalem, look on your right side. Pretty much when you get onto the highway, you'll see this building. Next, the Belza Synagogue, known as the Belza Beis HaMikdash in Jerusalem. It's a replica of the big shul they had in Belz. Next, Yeshivat Mir, named after the town Mir in Poland. Panovich, which unfortunately it's in the news now, I won't say why, but quite frankly, this is this Gemara coming to life. All the shuls around the world will eventually find their way to the land of Israel. And I think it would have been a terrible loss for the Jewish people if the founders of these yeshivas would have said, let's forget about our exile names. Let's just call it a shul. Why do we have to say we came from Lubavitch, Belz, Mir, Panovich? I think it would be a terrible loss because we're losing out on what they can bring to the table here in Israel. So I think that ultimately, by speaking English, you're bringing the English culture you came from to the land of Israel, and then you can benefit the people that live here. So for three reasons, I believe that despite the virtue, and there is a virtue of speaking Hebrew, for three reasons, I believe speaking English in Israel is a good idea. As a matter of fact, I on principle try to do it. Number one, it shows gratitude to your past. Number two, it actually shows diversity, which is the Jewish ideal. And number three, it actually brings the best of all worlds to the small land of Israel. Now you may be looking at me and saying, how do we know he's right? What do you mean you brought the best of all worlds? Where do we see it? So let me give you a few examples of where we see it in Israel. And I'm going to say this from personal experience because I came from America at a very young age. And I can tell you that since 1988, when I landed in this country, till the year 2021, I've seen changes because of various aliyot. The Russian aliyah had its contributions. The Ethiopian aliyah had its way to contribute. Let's talk about the Anglo aliyah and what it brought Israel. Did indeed they bring to the table things that we didn't have beforehand? So let's see. Here's a small list. Number one, customer service. When I came to Israel, there was no such thing as customer service. It didn't exist in the Israeli dictionary. There was no such thing. You had a complaint, you lived with it. I came to Israel in 1988. They told us we will get a phone between the day we come and 8 months from now. We got it after 6 months. We were lucky. They told us, basically, we will show up at your home. So make sure there's someone home from the day you come to Israel for 8 months. And if you're not there, you lost it. There was no cell phones and you had no telephone. So, you know, stay home for 8 months. Well, that's ridiculous. Who do I complain to? No one. Today, any company in Israel, cell phone companies, internet companies, etc., have customer service. You can complain, and we Jews, as you know, are very good at kvetching. Believe me, the complaints are there all the time, and there's customer service. Number two, competition. There isn't one phone company anymore. I don't even know how many cell phone companies there are, how many internet providers there are. Number three, a word I learned from a wonderful English woman, in this case from Manchester. She taught me a word I didn't know. When I was a kid, they told me to stand in line. I came to Israel, there was no such thing as a line. Not when you got onto a coach, not when you were waiting in the bank for a banker. She told me, in England, you say, stand in a queue. Today, you go into a bank, waiting for a coach, even waiting for a plane. People do wait online. They try to get on the line early. That's a Jewish way of getting onto a plane. But they wait in a queue. Number four, modern orthodoxy. There was no such thing for years in Israel. There was religious Zionism, which meant you were religious and Zionistic, but it didn't mean you were modern orthodox. Namely, you were orthodox and yet at the same time reached out with all 10 fingers to the best of the Western world. Today it exists because of the Anglos that made Aliyah. And I'm going to show an example in a moment. Shul-based rabbis. There were rabbis of cities in Israel, perhaps of neighborhoods. There wasn't shul-based rabbis. That's an Anglo invention that was imported into Israel from Anglo countries. Not only, but also. Finally, non-state-based anything. Israel was a socialistic country where everything was state-based. All of a sudden, you had private contributions to build a shul, to build a pool, a country club. All these things came from Anglo countries. So this is a small list of changes I've seen, and I can go on and on. Let me just give you one example. My own Rebbe, Rav Lichtenstein, Zichrono Livracha, I mentioned him earlier. He died a few weeks ago, but he was born today. So I want to give credit to his memory. If you look at this picture, everything about this picture is not Israeli. What do I mean? He came to Israel clean shaven. No rabbi in Israel is clean shaven. Next, short sideburns. Three, a jacket that's not black or blue at worst. It's supposed to be black, worst and worst, blue. Look at his jacket, checkered. He, even though he was called an outsider, was able to have the following on the day of his funeral. Now, those that know this paper, Hamodia, they're not a big fan of modern orthodoxy, but they couldn't pass over this event. When he died in 2015, more than 10,000 Jews from all over Israel took part in the Levaya of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichrono Livracha. The 10,000 Jews that were there, I was there, I'm a student, that's a given. There were Jews that were lily native Israelis that said this man impacted the Israeli scene. He did not give up his modern Orthodox Anglo-based upbringing. He brought it to Israel and impacted the country through the yeshiva that I was privileged to learn in and many others, but not just, to the extent that the state of Israel gave him the biggest honor they can give around a year plus before he died. And that's the picture you see here, what's called Pras Yisrael, the prize of Israel. This is the highest reward you can get in Israel. As you could see, it's given on Yom HaAtzma'ut, Israel Independence Day, given by the prime minister, the president, and whatnot. This was given to a man that came to Israel, didn't give up his Anglo upbringing, brought the best of his upbringing, in this case from North America, to Israel. 10,000 Jews came to his funeral, and I can promise you thousands more mourned his loss. So one example of many, and he's not the only one, of people that did not give up on their Anglo upbringing, culture, and language, and brought the best of it to Israel. But I can't say Israel is exactly perfect in this regard. Namely, if someone listened to this lecture and said, oh, you convinced me, you know, even though it's virtuous to speak Hebrew, obviously you want to give thanks to your past, you want to go ahead and show diversity, and you want to go ahead and bring the best of all worlds, you know, does it work? Does it work? And here I have to say that despite my idealistic thinking, it doesn't always work. For two reasons. Number one, Israelis like to eavesdrop. It's a terrible thing. You know, I was once at a bank machine in the UK. I had to take out some cash from the bank machine. I forgot why, because credit cards are pretty prevalent, but there must have been a reason. I was amazed. I'm at the bank machine. The person behind me was around 3-4 meters behind. This is before COVID. We didn't know about social distancing. And I was like amazed. They're not breathing in my neck. When I'm in Israel at a bank machine, they're looking over your shoulder and they're saying to you, oh, that's how much money you make? Oh, I make a little more. I make a little less. How do you do it? That's the way it is in this country. So it was very interesting to me. You know, they stood behind. Now, I could say, well, that's something to improve in this country. Mind your own business when it comes to your finances. Well, it also happens on the street. I'm walking down the street. I see someone. I start speaking to them in English. And right away, I get an Israeli come by and say, Daber be'ivrit, speak in Hebrew so I can eavesdrop. Well, that's part of a general culture here in Israel. And that is a culture that says, as I started the lecture, let's change our names because we have nothing to learn from the diaspora. Namely, there is a Chaver Knesset. I don't know if he's still in the Knesset because, as you know, in 2 years here in Israel, we went through 5 different Knesset. So I get mixed up who's in which Knesset. But in 2017, before this started, he did say the following statement. Hamidina ohevet et ha'aliyah, ach lo ohevet maspik et ha'olim. This country loves aliyah, but doesn't necessarily like the olim. Namely, they love the fact that you emigrate to Israel. They just don't know how to deal with immigrants. Now, let me give you an example of many of what I mean. You come to Israel, you make Aliyah, you're convinced. You come off the plane, you get all the wonderful kavod, the respect of coming to this country, and then you have to start working. So if you're a teacher, amongst the many things that is unique in this country, your salary will be based on experience and degrees. So there's a lady that comes from a certain country abroad with her degree. She didn't just come from a country with a degree. She came from a very Jewish known institution called Stern College. And she comes to Israel. And in 2019, on Facebook, she posts the following picture. Yes, I know it's in Hebrew, but you know what it means? My degree in education from Stern College was finally approved from the Ministry of Education. And then she wrote in big block letters, finally. So I asked this lady, well, when did you start the process? 2011. Anyone want to count? 2011, 2012, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. She comes to Israel for 9 years. She can't get a degree from a known institution abroad accredited, which means her salary was dirt bottom because she couldn't have a degree that was recognized. She's working in a school. She's living in Israel, paying taxes. Her son would go to the army. And yet, her degree is not accredited. Why? It's in English. It's not from Israel. If we're in a gathering of exiles, this can't happen. As a matter of fact, one of the people that wrote on that post wrote the following words. Been here for 15 years with 4 foreign degrees between us. None have been approved. By the way, these two people are working and for a living and in Israel, their degrees are not approved. If we're a country that believes in the ingathering of exiles, we celebrate the diversity, we want to show credence to the past, and we want to bring the best of all worlds to this country, this can't happen. We can't be a country that loves Aliyah but doesn't like Olim. We can't. We have to be a country that embraces people that came from their own cultures and a place that they felt at home to. And you have to make them feel at home in Israel. And their degree from a foreign university cannot take 9 years to be accredited. That just can't happen. So as much as I believe that it's ideal to speak English in Israel, unfortunately, it's not always that easy. And this is one of the many examples as to why. Allow me to conclude with the following statement. Rav Moshe HaKohen Sha'uli was the chief rabbi of the Iranian community in Israel. And he says that he lives in a wonderful country. Eretz Likuta'it hi artzenu. Our country is a country of ingathering. You gather up fruit, you gather up various things, they're never the same. Anyone that ever worked in a field knows that you gather oranges and apples and many other fruits at the same time. If you look at this particular picture, he says the following. We live in a country that has over 80 languages. Each subdivision of a community with their own way of life. Eretz Eretz Umanhigav. Each land and their own particular customs. You all know the Sephardic customs, even within the Sephardic communities, are different. And he says, those that say we should go ahead and merge them all into one, Einam yodim ma godel ha'efsed, they don't know how much they're going to lose from it, ve'hanezek, and the damage they're going to do if we're all the same. And he ends the way I would like to end. If you remember anything from this lecture, remember this vase with these flowers. I never understand people that buy flowers, but the fact that I don't understand it means I'm an ignoramus. My wife likes flowers, so I buy flowers, I put it in the vase, I put it on the table. The only thing I know about flowers is that they can't all be the same color. If you remember anything from this lecture, remember what Rav Moshe HaKohen says here. Israel should be like a flower pot, a vase with flowers. We shouldn't all be the same color. And speaking English is just one of the diversities that will make Israel a beautiful country like a beautiful bouquet of flowers. Thank you all very much for listening. You are a wonderful audience. Happy to take any questions you would like.
Thank you, Steve. Before I give my vote of thanks, just if anyone does have any questions, please do put them in the chat. Or if not, you can raise your hand. Not a problem either way. Whatever you feel comfortable with. What I wanted to say was, when Rabbi Grinstein and I were speaking last week, he said that he hasn't been in Birmingham since 2016. And as you know, or the rest of you know, that I moved to Birmingham in 2017. So I'd never met or spoken to Rabbi Grinstein before this week, or last week. But I'd heard of him. I knew about him. I'd heard of him and his connection with the shul. And now I understand why. So thank you very much for sharing such a wonderful and appropriate talk for Yom Yerushalayim. Really, really interesting, and I have to say, for me, I struggle terribly with languages, and despite a GCSE, which I didn't do very well in modern Hebrew, I seem unable to speak Hebrew, so it's comforting to know that if I do choose to make Aliyah, or if my Mashiach comes and we move to Israel, whichever comes first, that I will be able to continue speaking English and continue expanding the diversity, or at least perhaps I'll be tolerated. But thank you so much for joining us this evening. And I also want to thank Mizrahi for enabling Rabbi Grunstein to join us as part of their Yom Yerushalayim program. Does anyone have any questions?
Yes.
Go on, Lenny.
Before this lecture, as you were starting, I thought you were going to say the reason why people speak English in Israel is because they couldn't get to grips with the language. It's much easier to speak your own language than conquering. If we follow your train of thoughts, I come to live in Israel, and I'm encouraged by someone like yourself to speak English. Isn't there a danger that I'm never going to get to grips with the language of the land and sort of integrate that way? I mean, are you suggesting we should, on the one hand, speak English, but also learn in French? That's quite difficult to do, both, isn't it? You need to immerse yourself in the new language, do you not?
I believe it is very difficult to do. However, I started this talk by saying that I believe it is virtuous to speak Hebrew. Namely, if you would emigrate to a different country, I wouldn't necessarily say, oh, it's important if you go to, say, Uruguay to speak Spanish, if you can make do in English. I have been to many countries in the world that the vernacular is not English. I may do in English. In Israel, I can't step over or pass over the fact that Hebrew is virtuous. It is the holy language. We daven in it, we lean in it, and therefore I think it's important to learn it. However, I think that yes, we have to meet the challenge of a dual language. Namely, on the one hand, to continue speaking English, and on the other hand, to try to gain a proficiency in Hebrew. But you brought up a point that I can't negate, and that is that Anglos usually emigrate to Israel to communities that are very Anglo. So you probably know them by heart. I can go through some of them. They either make Aliyah to Efrat, where I live, to Beit Shemesh, to Netanya, and various other strongholds around the country in which English is proficient. And there it's even more difficult to learn Hebrew because you're not immersed in it. Now, I'll be honest, I made Aliyah, not to Efrat, to another community in Jerusalem. It wasn't easy to learn Hebrew. I made it my business to try. I was much younger, and I can't even fathom what it's like for older people. But I'll just say that this past Shabbos, even this morning, Lenny, you, I believe, davened in Hebrew, even though you spoke in English. So somehow you were already successful in 50% of the way of at least reading Hebrew. So I'm not so sure the next 50% will be impossible. Yes, any other comments or questions? With pleasure.
Rachel has a question.
I have a question. You spoke a bit about how perhaps Israel has a, I don't know if responsibility is the word, but to maybe sort out some of the bureaucracy and help integrate Anglos a little bit more and make it easy for us in terms of language, as Lenny said. Do you think that the diaspora also has a responsibility to ensure Jewish people, young Jewish people, are also equipped to go to Israel in terms of language? Because I think in the UK, particularly, I think it's probably different in America. In the UK, modern Hebrew is essentially not taught. It doesn't really matter whether you go to a very from Jewish primary school, secondary school, or whether you're, or community in London, Manchester, Birmingham. Across the board, it's not taught very well, and perhaps that sets people up in not the best ways or discourages people from making Aliyah.
I think it's a very, very good question, Rachel. First of all, pleasure to see you again. The last time we saw each other was at your parents' Shabbos table, if I'm not mistaken. Unless I'm getting the Rachel. I'm not recognizing the same Rachel.
Yes, same Rachel.
Okay, your father, I think your father's shaking his head, so I'm right on the Rachel. I think you're asking an excellent question, and that is, should schools around the world sort of sacrifice their Judaic studies in order to teach modern Hebrew? Because obviously there isn't time to do everything. So if you're going to invest more time in Hebrew, you're going to invest less time in Judaic studies. If that is indeed in the balance, I think the answer is very simple. Judaism and Judaic studies is far more important than Hebrew. Because you can be a very good Jew without knowing Hebrew. You can daven in the vernacular. You can say Shema in the vernacular. There's very few examples of things you can't do in the vernacular. The whole Pesach Seder to be done in the vernacular. But that's if push comes to shove. If push doesn't come to shove, I think it's important that Israel take responsibility over all Jews in the world. And part of their responsibility is to send people to teach Hebrew in these schools, in these communities. And I have to say, from my limited experience, it's very successful. I'll give you one story of many. When I was a rabbi in Canada, we had not a Jewish day school, but what's called a Hebrew school. It was pretty good, three times a week, not just on Sunday, but a few hours. That's it. I basically inherited a school that the minute you become bat mitzvah, bar mitzvah, you've graduated Judaism for the rest of your life. And I didn't think it was good, so I wanted to continue teaching these children. But I couldn't just say, let's continue learning together. That wouldn't get them through the door. And I couldn't say, give up your Sunday, because that was horrendous in and of itself when they had to do it. So I decided to use a ploy. I said, let's do a class on modern Hebrew. I had, let's just say, X amount of students, X minus one. All the students came to learn modern Hebrew. Now, the modern Hebrew I taught was via Judaism. I used examples from the Siddur, from the Bible. That was the way we did it. And their parents knew about it, and they knew about it. But why did they come through the door? Because they said, maybe one day we'd like to go to Israel, so we'd like to learn the language of the land. And somehow that brought them through the door. And incidentally, when I left the community, and the rabbi after me tried to continue, but he did not call it modern Hebrew, unfortunately, no students came through the door. So I think we have to invest time and effort, but it cannot be on the cheshbon, on the, it can't be in place of, at the expense of not learning Judaism and the Judaic subjects. It has to be in addition to, and obviously, if you have to cut a little, I can understand, but it can't be in place of. Because modern Hebrew, as important as it is, can't replace Judaism. So I hope I answered your question, Rachel.
Yeah, that's very good. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Do we have any more questions before we wrap up? Lorraine, if you unmute yourself. Thank you.
I'm going to be cheeky here, Rabbi. Is that your original family name? Or has that been changed along the line?
I have been offered from various people to change my name many times. I have no doubt, based on my research, that my family name means Greenstone Grunstein. It comes from the breastplate of the Grand Kohen. He had 12 stones. One of them was green. And that's probably where my name came from. And I was offered to change my name into a more Hebraic term of basically connoting it. And I refused. And the reason I refused was for the first reason I gave here tonight for speaking English. I want to show credence to my past, to my grandparents, to my great-grandparents I've never met, and not just say that I came off the cotton fields yesterday. I'll give you a small story to illustrate what I mean. But unfortunately, I cannot pronounce your name. How do you pronounce your name?
Mireille.
Mireille, okay. I knew there was a silent E there. Mireille. When I was in Antwerp for a Shabbos many years ago, I noticed that the time that they daven mincha, the afternoon service, was not exactly in consonance with Jewish law. Jewish law prescribes that you're supposed to finish mincha by sunset, and they sort of set mincha 20 minutes after sunset. And I didn't understand why. So I didn't want to be cheeky, so Friday night I was quiet. But after a few drinks Friday night at my host's home, and we were talking freely, I did pop the question. And I didn't know that sitting at the table was the gabbai of the shul. Now that was my big mistake. He looked right at me sternly. And he said to me the following words in Hebrew, I'll then explain in English. HaTorah lo itchila ב-1948. The Torah didn't begin in 1948. What did he basically tell me? He basically said, we have traditions in this community going back hundreds of years. Do you really believe that in the year 20-something, young Hakshat from Israel came in and he knows better and he's saying, hey, all these generations, you've made a mistake? And that story, I have to say, has been one of the main reasons why I didn't change my name. Namely, I don't want to tell my kids that the Torah began in 1988 when I came to Israel. I am building upon generations of generations in America, beforehand Poland, and that's why I'm here today. And one of the ways I show it is by leaving my last name. But you should know, Murray, that in English, it's easier to say. Grunstein. In Hebrew, it's very difficult. Greenstein. You have to sort of make your lips go like this. It's very difficult. So believe me, I've been offered by many a people, can you change your name? And I refused for that reason. I believe it shows credence to the past. Pleasure.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really lovely way to do, end proceedings this evening. Thank you again, Rabbi Grunstein, for your time. And thank you for everyone who came to listen this evening.
My pleasure. Thank you all for listening. It was great to see so many familiar faces once again. And I hope that when COVID is over, I'll be able to see you in person once again. It's great reconnecting at least this way. And wishing everyone a good week ahead, a happy Yom Yerushalayim, and a good Yom Tov as we head towards Shavuos next week.
Thank you.
Take care, everyone. All the very best. Oh, there you are. Hi, Deborah. Oh, very good. Okay.